I have no relationships to disclose. So the biological process that kind of inspired our method is that DNA through transcription leads to RNA and through translation to protein. But with splicing, you can get multiple RNA sequences and the consequent proteins produced by the same DNA sequence. So here, we have kind of an indirect pathway we're now interested in. We want to see if the SNP X acts on the phenotype of interest Y through this expression profile K. And so this is kind of, in most scenarios, we really care about the direct pathway. You know, is X directly causing Y? But now here in this scenario, we want to know about this indirect pathway. And kind of another example where we're interested in this is with endophenotypes. So if X is some sort of SNP, we might want to determine, is our SNP acting on lung volume through, say, smoking? So we assume no confounding here, but the method easily accommodates confounding because it's not really realistic to leave that out. Also, no population stratification, and we believe that there's some sort of basis for X to cause K. When you're dealing with expression profiles, it's very realistic to expect that your SNP's leading to your expression profile. So X is our coded genotype. Y is some sort of phenotype of interest. And K is either the RNA pathway of interest or your endophenotype. We assume a linear model that Y equals some X beta 1, where X is our SNP, plus K beta 2, K our expression profile, and epsilon. Epsilon's normal, zero, sigma squared identity. So we want to show that X acts on Y through K. So our alternative hypothesis becomes that we want to show that beta 1 equals 0 and beta 2 is non-zero. Then when we put both these things in our model, our expression profile is explaining the majority of what's going on. So then our null hypothesis occurs when beta 1 is non-zero or beta 2 equals 0, which gives us three scenarios. The first is that beta 1 is non-zero and beta 2 equals 0. Well, what does this mean? This means that X is acting on Y, but it's not acting the way you thought it was. It's not acting through this K. The second scenario is that beta 1 is non-zero and beta 2 is non-zero. This is saying that X is in fact acting on Y through K, but it's also acting on Y through some sort of other pathway that you're not accounting for. Or the third, kind of boring one, they're both zero. You know, your SNP's really not acting on your phenotype of interest. So the problem with this null and alternative hypothesis is that the MLE occurs when beta 1 and beta 2 are non-zero, and unfortunately the way this is set up, it occurs under our null. As a result, our likelihood ratio test is always going to equal 1, our score is always going to be 0, and other Bayesian factors, the simple ones that depend on the likelihoods, we really can't rely on them. So we're going to have to look to some sort of new method or a different method to compensate for this. And so we consider a simple Bayesian method. And in the standard setting, we have our posterior proportional to likelihood times the prior. We already assumed our likelihood was this normal with the genotypic data and the expression data. And we need priors for our beta 1, our beta 2, and our sigma squared. A classic choice of prior for the betas is some normal with a constant mean and a constant variance. The problem with this is we really want to show that beta 1 equals 0 and beta 2 is non-zero. But if we use these classic priors, it doesn't allow this to equal 0. So instead, we recommend using a spike and slab prior for the betas. This is similar to Yan and Ling or Chipman's approach. Their approaches focus more on using a very large number of covariates, whereas here we only have two, but it still works out. And what's nice about this allows the betas to equal zero, so we can really answer the question we're looking at. So as we saw before, Y, given our beta 1, beta 2, gammas, and sigma squared, is this normal? Now we're going to assume that beta given sigma squared, and we introduce gamma, is this gamma I normal zero CI, where CIs are constant, and that the gammas are Bernoulli pi I for pi I is constant. So what is this saying? Okay, well, if gamma 1 is 0, then what happens is the prior for beta 1 becomes 0 and it becomes dropped out of our model. If gamma 2 is 1, then we have a normal prior for this, and it's included in our model. So we're able to answer a question if x is acting on y through k by just simplifying it down to seeing if gamma 1, 0, and gamma 2 is 1. And then to be non-informative as possible, we put a flat prior on sigma. And you'll note if the pi i's are half, what is this saying? It's kind of equally letting it be 0 or 1, and so it's not putting too much bias on the models a priori. So then we simulated the data to see, you know, like in theory this method should work, but does it work when you simulate the data? So you generated x from a binomial distribution with different allele frequencies, and we simulated this DAG, where x is acting on y through k, but very realistic setting. So the correlation for x and k is 0.1, the correlation for x and y, 0.01, and the correlation for k and y, 0.05. with 1,000 subjects and 5,000 simulations for each allele frequency. And our results were actually really great. Here, the different colors represent the different allele frequencies from 0.05 to 0.45. You do see a bit of change, but they're clumped together, so it doesn't really make much of a difference. And the first graph, it'd probably be good if I told you what that is, it's the posterior means for gamma 1. And so, for all the simulations, the majority of the posterior means for gamma 1 are around 0.225. And what does a posterior mean of gamma 1 of 0.22 mean? Well, what this is saying is that 22% of the mass of the posterior distribution occurs at 1, and 78% occurs at 0. Well, that implies that gamma 1 most likely is 0. For gamma 2, we're seeing that the majority is around 0.91, 0.92. And a posterior mean of gamma 2 at 0.92 is saying that 92% of the mass of the posterior distribution is at 1, 8% at 0, gamma 2 is 1. So we've shown through our simulations that gamma 1 we can likely assume is 0, and gamma 2 is 1, and so that x is in fact acting on y through k. So the simulations show what we hope to prove, which is great. We then applied this method to the CAMP data set. This is a childhood asthma data set. We used Y, immunoglobulin E, for our phenotype of interest, and we adjusted this for age and gender. This was a huge GWAS, but of the GWAS, there was only 5 SNPs and their 5 corresponding expression profiles that were significantly associated with the phenotype. And so we just ran this method 5 times for those 5 SNPs with their corresponding expression profiles. 4 of them did not act on IgE through the expression profile of interest, but one of them, the SNP RS10739927, and its corresponding expression profile had very good results. The posterior mean of gamma 1 was 0.22, which is great, close to 0. Posterior mean for gamma 2 was 0.80, close to 1, which is great because we want to, you know, the posterior mean of gamma 1 to be close to 0, gamma 2 close to 1. And then kind of to back up this, we looked at the 95% confidence bands for beta 1 and beta 2 as further evidence. The confidence band for beta 1 contained 0, beta 2 didn't, which strongly suggests that the SNP is acting on IgE through this expression profile of interest, which means in this case we determined how it's acting biologically. So in conclusion, the advantages of this method is that because of the way the null and the alternative would have been set up in the frequentist setting, no standard methods really work. Our simulations show that using this method performs quite well. It's also applicable when K is an endophenotype in a scenario where you have, like, say, SNP and smoking and lung volume. Because it's not really a standard method, there is an R function if you email me. And then YK Yip at one of the postdocs at Harvard with Christoph Ling, we're working on a software package that's more accessible. The disadvantage is it's Bayesian, so there's no standard cutoff to reject H-naught. You can't just say, oh, you know, alpha is 0.05. So that's bad, but. And I'd like to thank my advisor, Christoph Ling, and Scott Weiss, Sunita Sharma, and Benjamin Raby at the Channing for letting me use their data set. Thank you.
Well, thanks to all of the students for giving us some very interesting presentations. We have a few minutes left for questions. Is there anyone in the audience that would like to ask a question? Yes.
A question of the first presenter. Did you consider doing any type of matching among treatment and control in terms of any factors that might have predicted differences in compliance between the treatment groups? It wasn't clear to me that you had done any matching. You just went directly to the causal end.
Are there any other questions? I was just curious, Miguel, what was factor two? you gave some intuition of what factor one and factor three were, but you didn't say.
Right, so factor two, we're still thinking about what, we're still looking at the literature to figure out what's going on. There's a lot of cancers that seem like they might be related in some sort of mechanism, but we're still trying to identify that.
Is that breast cancer and soft tissue?
Yeah, that's for males. So yeah, male breast cancer.
Factor 3 was kind of in that area.
Yeah. So there are a lot of miscellaneous cancers in factor 2 that we're currently investigating. Mm-hmm.
But before what we knew, potentially.
Any other questions? Yeah.
I have a question for you.
So the answer is actually, thanks for the question, first of all. The answer is actually quite simple. So for this, this actually the 3D plot shows the intuition. You can see that when the parameter of interest and the nuisance parameter are highly correlated, the top of this mountain is very flat. So when you use the joint estimation, you can end up with some point actually that is quite far away from the true MLE, maximum. So it's also involves some algorithm problem. So this is because of, the short answer for your question is that the reason is that the top of this surface is flat when the parameters are highly correlated. So the efficiency you gain from using the pseudo-likelihood estimate is that when you fix the parameter, let's say this gamma at one point, if you fix that point, then you look at the instead of the joint likelihood, you look at a slice likelihood. This likelihood function is much more quadratic than the joint one. So that's the intuition.
And what's the price
you
pay for this?
The price? Uh-huh. So the price we paid is that, you know, if sample size is infinity, then MLE must be more efficient than the pseudo MLE, right? But in finite sample, you know, actually we find that the pseudo the maximum pseudo likelihood estimate is more efficient, so I don't think more price we need to pay. Okay, thanks.
Okay, well, I think our time is. Oh, yeah, you have one more question?
Definitely, that was higher in the county tax rate. have any insignificant. So the reason why I really remember that the Suburban function was exponential for this factor. So exponential of a sum, we can factor exponential of the relatives, exponential of the covariates, right, and exponential of the baseline. So you take e to the 0 is 1, and this is going to be the biggest possible value because all of the all variables are negative, right? E to the minus something. So here that for all the other variables, this county that doesn't have a relative significance is going to be the one with the higher risk for death. The relative risk of death at certain time. So this is the relative risk of death at certain time for this county is going to be the higher. Okay, thank you. Okay. Well, the cure rate is just average, right, over the whole time. So that's.
Okay, well, I think we should give all of the presenters another hand for some very excellent presentations.